Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting edition of the Vinny Eastwood Show. We have an unscheduled guest today. Incidentally, he sent me an email saying, look, I'm 83 years old and every day that I wake up is a new day, so we need to pre-record because I can't schedule it or anything like that. And, I was just like, well, bugger it, we'll just bring him on right now then. His name's Victor H. Fisher. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. This is, it was a surprise, a pleasant surprise for me to wake up this morning.
Yeah. I'm actually quite glad too, because I had two other scheduled guests and I had a pleasant surprise that they won't reply. So here we are. Would you be able to divulge a little bit about who you are and what you do, Victor, for the audience who don't know?
Well, I'm basically a scientist and engineer and many things. I really like to call myself a cyberneticist. In the purest sense, because most of my activity that I've done through my many years in research and engineering have been involved in control systems and looking at the large picture rather than counting angels on the head of the needle. But I recently, back in the early 60s, I was gifted to have a opportunity to do some research in the mental health area. It was just one of these types of situations that everything just sort of came together magically. How I got into that particular area was that I was involved in instrumentation, design, and utilization. And I joined Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, which is still the largest research foundation, privately owned foundation in the world. While I was shortly after I joined them, my boss asked me to that he was interested in medical electronics instrumentation, and that I should spend some time and review the different types of equipment that it was being utilized at that time in the medical field. Shortly after, within just a few days, actually, I came across the electroencephalograph as being an instrument that appeared to me initially as being not working the way it was anticipated to work. Brought this to my boss's attention, and he said, "Well, why don't you look into it a little deeper?" So I went back to the drawing board, so to speak, and did a much more thorough investigation as to what type of data that or input that the electroencephalograph was getting from the brain and the nervous system. And it turned out that it appeared that the information was a series of pulses that all had exactly the same amplitude. And therefore, the the only thing that could transmit information would be the time period between pulses, which would be basically the frequency of these pulses. Because it from actual study analysis of nerve potentials, it was noted that the amplitude of the pulses were always exactly the same, but the frequency changed, and it changed interestingly enough as related to the intensity. So as a nerve receptor like the eye or ear or any of the sensory system would be stimulated, that the higher the level of stimulation generated a higher frequency. And then if in reverse, as the stimulation was reduced, the frequency would reduce. So that with that as a basis, it became very evident to me at that time to measure the frequency of these pulses. And so I, instead of the amplitude, and so I ended up with a frequency counting on a continuous basis, a streaming basis, frequency counting apparatus, instrument. And and shortly after I came to that kind of a conclusion, lo and behold, magically, we get a telephone call, Battelle does, from the mental hospital in Columbus, and that they wanted an instrument engineer to come out to their hospital and help one of the doctors with his instrumentation problems. And needless to say, I went out there and talked with this doctor. He was doing some using radioactive injections to see what kind of flow of blood flow in the human brain. He was trying to see if there was any correlation between blood flow and different mental problems. And he had some apparatus to measure this this dye, radioactive dye that he was injecting. And really, it was interesting to him, but then when I illustrated my thoughts about the electroencephalograph, not only he, but quite a few of the other psychiatrists there picked up on it and said, well, gee, this is what we want to do. We want to test your apparatus. And history was made or started just by this serendipity combination of desires. And so I took over a prototype just a couple days later, because I already had an idea what I wanted to do. And allowed me to hook into their electroencephalograph, pick up the same information, and work in parallel with their electroencephalograph and my equipment, which I ended up calling a hyperfrequency electroencephalograph, or a HIFREG short. But one of the things that we observed almost immediately was that the two hemispheres of the human brain had different patterns. What I mean by that, the frequencies was higher on one hemisphere than it was on the other hemisphere in corresponding areas, lateral areas. And we noticed that most of the patients that we had tested, even the first 25 patients that we tested, that we had almost, it was 100% correlation between this differential between the two hemispheres and their handedness. Subject that had a dominant left hemisphere were always right-handed. But interestingly enough, when we the opposite of that, when the right hemisphere was dominant, it would be a left-handed person, but we noticed that some of the subjects, and it was a small percentage, like 10% or so, would have a left-hand dominant hemisphere and be left-handed. But then when we observed closer, we noticed that those, what we finally call a pseudo-left-hander people, which Obama and Bush Jr. Represent. In fact, I think even Clinton was a pseudo left-hander. If you'll notice, when they sign with their left hand, their hand is twisted, it's sort of upside down. Instead of normally like you would write as a right-hander, your fingers are pointing away from you. In their case, their tips of their fingers are pointing towards their body. And in fact, they'll sometimes even turn the paper 90 degrees and they write uphill or away from themselves instead of across in front of themselves. And we saw that that was, again, another 100%er. I mean, we were able to pick out the pseudos right away. So starting with that as a beginning, which, interestingly enough, the standard electroencephalograph was not you didn't give any indication of handedness. In fact, they have what they called... it was a mirror image kind of a situation where with a standard electroencephalograph, like in epilepsy, mirror focus was the term that they'll say that the damaged area for the epilepsy would be on the right-hand side, and when they would go in to do brain surgery, it was actually on the left-hand side. mistake occurred almost exactly 50% of the time. So it was obvious that they were just guessing. They didn't get any real information from the electroencephalograph. In fact, I sort of term the standard electroencephalograph that is still being used today just a Ouija board. There's no real indication. In fact, actually, most of the modern electroencephalographs are not even measuring brain waves. They're measuring... what we call electromyelographs. They measure the impulses in the muscles on the surface of the skin, or just below the surface of the skin, and they're not even seeing anything that's coming from the from internal. When we did our research, we used needle electrodes, whereas they have sort of paste-on electrodes now. But the thing that we also noted was that with the needle electrodes, you could get in between the hair follicles. And when you did that, you're nowhere near a nerve ending, because it turns out that the hair follicle, where it, the hairs grow out of, has the nerve endings. And if you go into the space between hairs, they don't even feel anything. In fact, we in our sleep studies, they have needles stuck in their heads all night long. And needless to say, we did that with girls because they were more used to having stuff on their head while they're sleeping. And so that was whereas I think I would stay awake all night if they had me all hooked up with that stuff. But basically, what we did ran the tests on my equipment. We had 11 psychiatrists.
Doctor, hold on a second. We're about to come to break in just a second here. Okay. When we come back, I want you to kind of just hold that thought and continue going on. And this will be kind of like the way of the interview today. We're just going to kind of let you speak and lay out all your research, because there's quite a lot of it to do of your 83-year history. So, Victor H. Fisher, PhD, is my guest. He's a brain extraordinaire expert dude. And we'll be right back after the break. The Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the sexiest 2 hours in talk radio. And we're talking with the fabulous... are you a professor? I forget what to call people who've got a PhD. Victor H. Fisher.
Just a doctor.
Just a doctor.
Actually, the real doctors. The medical profession, they're not really doctors.
Yeah, well, I think a doctor's supposed to heal people, and based upon that thing, yeah, they're not real doctors. Anyway, if you've managed to hold your thought over the break, you've got a few more minutes to explain about the brain and how you can empirically decide via evidence whether or not somebody's left-handed or right-handed. I'm not 100% sure where you're going with it, but
well, what that indicated was that we were actually able to see the healthy tissue. And also in opposition to that, wherever we had a patient that had traumatic damage to their brain, we were able to see that immediately, where the standard electroencephalograph could only see epilepsy, and even there they never learned anything about epilepsy. Which we'll get into a little bit later when we talk about healing epilepsy. But how the program evolved after 100 patients were tested and reviewed, compared with their medical records, and we saw a very high correlation to various mental problems, mental health problems. We wrote up a report, and it was published by the Battelle Memorial Institute in their journal. And report was called the new window into the human brain. Caused a lot of excitement at that time. The journal American Medical Association picked up on it and described the and verified that this was breakthrough technology, that basically the concept of a sort of an FM method of detection compared to the standard electroencephalograph, which is more like an AM amplitude oriented system, that we were the first to come up with that concept. And interestingly enough, concept has been now established, but there has been no replication of our that I know of our original work, and that is sort of interesting in two different respects. One is that after that we did that 100, the state became very interested in our research. And especially since we had a unanimous vote of confidence from all of the psychiatric staff that this was breakthrough technology, that they allowed us a budget to build a research a laboratory, which I included steel shielded rooms so that we would eliminate any extraneous radioactivity or microwave activity, because the what we were measuring on the electroencephalograph was very, very small signals. And which had to be amplified many times over, but these rooms were so tight that you could take a little portable radio into the room and it was dead. It couldn't pick up any signal at all. And so we conducted 400 more tests in that room, and also we conducted six sleep studies all night. We ran both the equipment continuously for 8 hours through the night. And we learned an awful lot about that. And we also did some work by actually injecting some of the drugs that were being introduced at that time into the bloodstream and seeing the effects of these various drugs. After testing 500 subjects, we found that the technique of the clinical technique of evaluation of various mental problems, we were able to, the psychiatrists, our team was able to predict with almost 100% correctness what the equipment would tell us. We did a thorough double-blind experimentation where the operator of the Heifrig had no contact at all, really, physical contact with the subject, as well as never saw what the history was, the medical history was, which no electroencephalographer will ever give a reading until he reads or she reads the medical history. So they really just don't know what they're doing. We'll put it that way. It's just that cut and dry.
Those encephalographs, are those machines expensive?
Which, my equipment?
No. The other ones. The ones that you say don't know what they're doing.
Well, they're fairly expensive, but they're not, needless to say, they're not as expensive as some of the equipment that they're using now, like MRIs and CAT scans. Those are big bucks, millions of dollars, and they don't tell you anything. In fact, they do more damage than they give you any information on. Mm. Main reason for that is that all that they can do is illustrate what's going on in the memory system. It doesn't have any now. They've not been able to read. Get any data that tells. In fact, even handedness, you can't tell handedness with them. So if you can't do handedness, you're doing nothing. You're really. It's sort of like saying, "Well, I'm going to study what data is in your hard drive in your computer." Just looking at zeros and ones doesn't tell you anything. Especially, it doesn't tell you anything about the CPU, and it doesn't tell you anything about what's going on, where the CPU is located. From our study, we anticipate that there's at least 16 CPUs in the brain, human brain.
16 of them. Right.
Yeah.
What do you mean the 16 processors? Do they all do the same thing, or do they all have different processing functions?
Well, in one sense, they do exactly what a computer's CPU does, is just processes data. But it's they're in unique areas, like for rational thinking and anticipation. They're up in the anterior, up in the front part of the brain. In fact, it's almost in the temporal region, just behind or right near where the eyes are. There's two, one on each side there. Then for all of the, for visual, see, the problems you run into with the nervous system itself is that you have sensors, a sensory system for different things, eyes and ears and nose and touch and all those balance, which is actually the sixth sense. All of those things are fed by a bundle of nerves. Like, for instance, in the eyes, the optic nerve that goes back to the back part of the brain, the occipital area, has 1.25 million nerve fibers in each one, in each optic nerve. And so in normal way of hooking up, what we do in industry and what we do in computers is we tag a wire, both ends of the wire, so we know that this is this wire goes between this one area, one point, and goes to the other point. In these bundles, you have what we call synaptic areas. We have connections between neurons, and in the optic area, you might have 100 or 1,000 of these synaptics points. That is between the retina and the occipital of the back in the brain. So you have also a crosstalk problem. You have two fibers that are different areas, actual individual receptors, and you don't want them to have affect another nerve fiber that is adjacent to it. So this is why you have this pulse deal going on, because by pulsing it, we have like the FM radio, it cuts out static. And so the pulse is necessary to cut out crosstalk. But the problem you have at the other end is how do you hook up, which wire do you hook up to designate a certain area? Like when you looking at your microphone there, you don't see pieces of the microphone or your background or any pieces of the curtains or anything else like that. They're just floating around. Everything is continuous. The microphone is solid object and it has solid geometry, and your wire that to your earphones are connected. There's not pieces of it floating around. So that the only way that there can be a logic simulated from all these data points is through a CPU. What that does is it makes it analyzes on a context basis. That if you take like a doorway, if you take your hand and slide it up and down the doorway, you can that gives you a clue that edge is continuous, and so that gets fed back to the back part of the brain, and then says, well, these points should be adjacent to each other. So everything is now continuous. So basically, that's where you get the 16 different CPUs, because they have to reorganize. In fact, way back in at the turn of the 1900, they experimented with the eyes and put prisms in front of the eyes, like glasses with a prism, and the way they did this is that half of the visual field was flipped over, and so the bottom half of the eyeglasses you see normal, but the top half was flipped over, so the top was it was in the middle now, and the middle was at the top. Well, within a week, the brain accommodated to that new pattern of information, and everything was normal.
Well, that's interesting. It's quite adaptive that way. We're coming up to a break again now. Dr. Victor H. Fisher is a brain expert, and he is my guest today for 2 hours. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. I hope you like a jamming tune. I want to jam it. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to AmericanFreedomRadio.com. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and my very special guest today is Dr. Victor H. Fisher. Welcome back to the program. Now, what I've got to illustrate to the audience here is also you have quite an in-depth knowledge of not only the functions of the brain and its layout and all that, but also how humans behave. And one of the interesting conversations we had most was about how the difference between the male and the female brain operates. Would you be able to elaborate a little bit on that? Unless, of course, you'd like to continue along your original vein, and we'll touch on it next hour.
No, that's very, very interesting, because while you were during the break, I was anticipating talking about the difference between the male and the female brain. So you're reading my mind. So many thousand miles away. That's a very interesting subject, because there has been so much written about either the similarity or the differences between the male and the female brain. But being a cyberneticist, I look at the big picture instead of the narrow picture. It's always easier to design something complex. It's very difficult to design something that is very simple. And it takes a long time of tweaking to get something simple. What has happened in the since the start of psychology is to make the brain study very complex. And what we found was that it's extremely simple, and it has to be just from a genetic point of view, because the only source of input, the architecture, the design, and the manifestation, the physical manifestation of a person is contained with a pair of chromosomes. Many pairs of chromosomes in the single fertilized ova. So that is then divided, and then those are divided, and they are divided and multiplied, and finally you get a body, and you get a person and a brain. So the brain and the central nervous system is just a replication of many identical elements, because it's just it can't be complex. It's got to be very, very simple. So what the mistake that most people make is that they look at the brain as being some sort of a magical crystal ball, and they say, well, gee, the male and the female act differently. They behave differently, therefore their brains must be different. In reality, from our study, the brain is almost identical. The difference is not the brain, but the central nervous system itself. The female has a different role that she has demands made on her that the male does not have. And for her to fulfill her role, she has to have much more sensitivity to her environment, and not only her environment, but her offspring's environment. And where the male is a couch potato, when his wife would say, you know, watch the kids. He'll try to make an acknowledgement that he will, but that lasts a very short period of time, and the kids are on their own because he's just not wired, and that's really the proper way of describing it. He is not wired for that type of task.
I've noticed that. Men kind of thrive on interaction, whereas a lot of times childcare is just kind of sitting back and observing. And I'm just not that good at that. Much better when I'm actually interacting, you know, hands-on playing, that kind of thing.
No, it's in the case of the female, their visual view, their capability of seeing out the side of their head instead of with blinders that the male has on and can only see straight forward, offers a large amount of additional information in hearing. They can hear higher pitches and also lower intensity than the male of sound. In smelling, they smell much more sensitive than the male smells. Their taste is much more sensitive than the male. The touch, the feeling of touch, is much more sensitive. In virtually all of the five senses, the female is picking up and transmitting back into the brain many times more data than is going back to the male's brain. Now, this is all necessary so that the sensitivity is necessary so that she can be aware of potential problems, not only to herself but also to the offspring and their living conditions. The brain is still processing at the same rate, same speed, same amount of data can pass through it. So this is where we see the behavior changes, that the female is much more is processing much more data and has much more opportunity to come up with different conclusions based on this vast amount of new data, which she can go into information overload a lot faster than the male can. And so the male operates at less amount of data. Therefore, they can come to a conclusion very quickly, which is necessary if they get into an aggressive kind of a situation where the male is being attacked physically and or even mentally, that his fight or flight reflex has to be responsive very quickly. He can't analyze what to do. In fact, the training of a boxer is to make decisions faster than the brain can make those decisions. So it has to be secondhand. Literally, a boxer can be knocked out and still continue fighting because the conscious part of the brain can be shut down, and the training and condition reflexes that he has acquired during training allows him to still stay up on his feet and still continue fighting.
What happens if there's hormone changes or new hormones introduced? Like, you know how bisphenylalanine, the BPA in the plastic bottles and stuff like that, mimics estrogen in the body? Would that change a male's brain function?
The males or the females?
Males or females.
Well, the problem that you're running into right now is that the commercial area of both the food industry and everything associated with that, as well as the medicine industry, is to introduce toxic materials. Basically, plastic is cheap and it's easy to work with. And whereas in the days past, all your milk was always in glass bottles, and even your Coke and was glass, and which are totally non-toxic. So the what has happened is that we're now into a phase of trying to make people sick purposefully, because if you can make them sick, then you can glean some money from them. But if they're healthy, you can't get any money from them.
Yeah, there's just no money in healthy people these days.
That's right.
You know, I mean, health care. What is health care? It's not actually caring for your health. It's caring for the health of somebody's bank account, but certainly not yours.
That's right.
Yeah. Dr. Victor H. Fisher, brain expert, is my guest for the next hour as well, and we will be talking about a lot of interesting things. One element that I would like to explore as well is when you're moving house and the nesting syndrome, differences between males and females. Any man who's ever moved house with his missus knows that she starts going, it appears to the man as if she's going crazy. And Victor will be able to explain exactly why that happens, because of the intense nesting instinct. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Broadcasting live from New Zealand, the fabulously fluoridated island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's a freaking gorgeous day. There's not even a single chemtrail. But, oh my God, doesn't happen very often. My very special guest is Dr. Victor H. Fisher. Now, nesting instinct. What can you tell us about this?
Okay, the interesting, that leads us into another interesting area about how the brain is designed.
Now, you say the word designed as opposed to evolved. Is that on purpose?
Well, it initially, it's just like any computer. You have a bunch of components that is you call the hardware, and every computer has exactly the same elements. They have a RAM, they have a CPU, they have a hard drive, they have IOs, inputs, keyboards and mouses and monitors and all these sort of things. They're all exactly the same, but they don't work the same way. Because there, some of them, in fact, I just put a new motherboard in my computer, and it's just like a different machine. It has different capacity. And in fact, in my book, I make this correlation between computers and the brain. To explain much of how the brain is structured, the architecture, because basically they both have to do handle data the same way, and the response has to be the same. So it's not a big surprise that they are they're almost identical. In the case of the brain. It has multi memory systems. They have up in the frontal part is the short-term memory, and then in the middle and the back, just before the occipital area, where the optic system works or processed, is the long-term memory. And
you told me once that women have the long-term memory kind of hardwired in, like they see something in a certain location and they'll remember exactly where it is, which is the reason why I always lose my stuff And I always ask my missus if she can find it, and she always can.
No, you were close. I was talking about at that point was the short-term memory. They have a bigger, a much larger capacity in the short-term memory than the male does. But that's all that is, just like adding a little bit more RAM. So they're having a higher gigabyte of RAM than the male does. But because here again, the male doesn't really need a lot in that area. Like animals don't have hardly none. So it's not necessary for you to have a lot of short-term memory. In fact, the German shepherds that Pavlov use have virtually no short-term memory, and he was dealing with the long-term memory. In fact, interestingly enough, your short-term memory, which is your conscious memory, when the short-term memory shuts down, which it does first, about a half hour before the long-term memory shuts down, you lose consciousness. So consciousness is determined by the short-term memory. And in many cases, especially retrospective individuals, the conscious part of the mind is, in most cases, your worst enemy. So the subconscious is your best friend. Why I say that is that the long-term memory, the subconscious part of the brain, is your intuitive memory. The data that is located in the long-term memory is only answers. There's no connection to answers to questions, and there's no way of determining why that answer is there. It's just there. And the reason for that is that it's much more efficient that if you have a conflict, you have a question, you just want an answer. You don't care how you got that answer. You just want an answer. And in fact, in information theory, no information can pass without a preceding a question. All information are answers to questions, even in information theory. Now in communication theory, which is slightly different, the question is not necessary. It's all you're doing there is dealing with data. You're not trying to resolve anything. The only way that you can get into long-term memory, the answers into long-term memory, is that that particular question or particular answer has to be repeated many times. Pavlov said that it had to be at least 12 times. Response had to be inputted at least 12 times in a short period of time, and then it gets into the long-term memory. Now, the long-term memory has both EEPROMs, and using the analogy of computer memory, which means that it can be added or changed, and it also has just ROMs, which is hardware. And so when I talk about the evolution of survival questions, that evolves over many generations, many hundreds of generations, really, because the environment doesn't really change much. And so your questions or your responses are just replicated, many millions of times. And so the that allows a hardwire answer rather than a conditioned answer from your environment. So that would be what we would call just a random read-only memory. And there again, those are things, like, for instance, in the case of the female, many college-trained females especially get sucked in that you have to learn how to be a mother. And nature took care of that long, long, long time before there was ever a college. So all of those, that's a survival, what I call a survival intuition or survival ROM answer. The nature would not, the human species would not survive if every new mother has to be taught how to be a mother. And this is the same memory system that the mother bird has to build not only the how to build a nest, but where to build the nest. Because if she builds a nest on the ground, needless to say, the egg's going to get consumed.
Now, this goes back into the nesting instinct itself, and this I believe we had a conversation about this a while back about moving house and how it's really traumatic for a female, whereas a male not quite so much.
Well, the here again, the problem with the, again is what we talked about earlier, and that is that the female has so much new data that she is being thrown at her, this is a very catastrophic event to move because she has to destroy, in a sense, her present nest, and then she has to build a new nest, and the opportunity of not knowing, how she did it in the first place becomes very traumatic because she's got to, she knows she's got to do it, but she doesn't know, how did she make those decisions in the first place? Because again, it's intuitive. You only have the answers and never how do you derive those answers. So you could try to reevaluate where your mistakes were, because the data is already there. There's no, it's not a mistake. That's why I was saying that that your subconscious intuitive mind has all the right answers, or usually has, as far as survival is concerned, they have the right answers. Now, you can have in the book, I do a case study on the movie Beauty and the Beast, and in that movie, the Beast had generated a beastly like attitude because he could not, after he was converted into the Beast, could not imagine anybody ever loving the Beast. So he had a lot of time between when he was converted into, morphed into the Beast to the time that the flower dropped its last petal, which would have made him a beast forever. But by a change in his environment with Belle, the beauty, his real nature came out. And that real nature was a prospective and a loving person. which surprised Bell, needless to say. But in the female, see, again, this illustrates that the brain is different, that the only a minor amount of like the short term memory is different, but only slightly. Her sensory system is just so overwhelming with data that she just goes into is normal. They just go into a state of almost shock. With some comfort, TLC, on the male's part, as long as he's sensitive to this condition and is supportive of her challenge, then everything works out very good in the long run.
Yeah, and this is just kind of like a quiet, reassuring, understanding, don't worry, baby, I'll help you rebuild the nest.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, see, like, I was the first undergraduate to major in genetics at Ohio State University. And therefore, all of my courses in my major were graduate-level courses, which included PhDs as well as some master's.
Hold on, what exactly is an undergraduate? Is it kind of like Phantom of the Opera, he lives under the stage, or?
I'm sorry, what was this?
What exactly is an undergraduate? Is it kind of like the Phantom of the Opera, how he lives underneath the theater?
No, that's the first 4 years is the undergraduate. And then you have your master's, which is a couple of years usually, and then you have your PhD, which is another 2 or 3 years on top of the master's. So the undergraduate is your bachelor's degree. And so during my bachelor time, I was taking only, by the time I graduated, I had taken every graduate course in genetics. And if I would have gone on for a master's, I'd have to go to another university because there was the Ohio State wasn't. I had already taken all their courses, so I had as an undergraduate in my first 4 years had a PhD level training. During that time, I also was assigned a research project. And my research mentor was doing work with mice. And so we had a big mouse room with about 1,000 mice in that room. And I noticed that the male mouse was very supportive of the female in only one area. And that was that he would the bedding was cedar chips, and so the he would chew up the bigger chips to make a softer bed for the female when she was nesting and just before birth of the little mice. But as soon as the kids were born, he would just go off to this corner of the cage and had no interest, no concern about what was going on. That was mummies.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about this after the break. Victor H. Fisher, Dr. Victor H. Fisher is my guest. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And if you don't know that all these shows are archived yet, go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and check out the radio archives there because there's copious quantities of interviews we've done with many, many people. A lot of knowledge to absorb. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. it's the lighter side of genocide, because in the world so full of chaos and madness and psych medication that turns you into a werewolf, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts. Yeah. Anyway, we wanted to talk about mental health and mind control. Now, Victor, you were explaining to me over the break that mind control is actually a lot more simple than people realize. It's just fear, really. And now I know why the media and the government have so much control over everybody. And conversely, the police as well. You know, whenever I see a cop in front of me with that blue uniform and a big smile, it scares the living piss out of me.
That's true. From our research, we found that there is a continuum, but on a normal curve between prospective people and retrospective people. And what I mean by those two terms is that on the extremes, let's start from the middle. There's actually about a third of the population is in each of those three classifications. And about a third of the population, it would be prospective, which means that at the extreme, they are very highly anticipatory correctly. And so when we were talking about the intuitive memory, I said that the intuitive memory is always correct. And so your first answer to any conflict is usually correct. And when you have the opportunity to analyze, if you're prospective, you'll get the same answer. If you're retrospective, you get an opposite answer, which then puts you into a dilemma, because it's in the same brain. You have two different answers, and they're opposite each other. So you have to, the only way you can resolve that dilemma is go to an outside source, either another human being or a library source or Google source. To break that tie, that dilemma. The middle group is non-anticipatory. They can't anticipate anything. In a large sense, they're the happiest, because if you have the capability of being prospective, you usually are an outcast because two-thirds of the population can't understand why you are that way. Two-thirds of the population is either non-anticipatory or is negatively anticipatory.
Can I offer something here? This reminds me of Dr. Bob Malamede, who's been touring U.S. universities talking about cannabinoids, endocannabinoids specifically. And he talks about how our culture is currently split between what he calls blips and flips, forward-looking people and backward-looking people.
Yeah, that's basically a good way of describing the retrospective and prospective. The retrospective only can operate out of the rearview mirror. They can't see anything forward. And so this is why they are always in a state of fear, because it's sort of like the blind person coming to a curb. He can't see that it is a curb until he gets some other external information, either a seeing-eye dog or his cane or something else. And Otherwise, he wouldn't move at all. That's just sort of it. They do get a good sense of location in their house or in their room and where the furniture is, but don't change the furniture because that blows them away. But see, that type of sense of location of things in their room is the same CPU reaction to sighted people making sure that the objects are located where they're supposed to be, that you can actually touch a frame of a picture when you reach up your hand and it's really there. You're not missing it from your visual input. So consequently, the retrospective individual, and that's what really the word retrospective means, is looking at at what has happened already, the historical events rather than future events. And the prospective is obviously anticipating a future event based on your input, your data input, connecting all the dots, so to speak. So the consequently, the both the retrospective and lesser so for what I call the normal people, non-anticipatory.
Is there a middle ground here? Like you said, there's prospective and retrospective, and the middle is just spective?
Well, they're what you really would call the normal. The normal is non-anticipatory, and the most normal is one that is in the middle between physically motivated individuals versus mentally motivated individuals.
Is there a minority or a majority of one group or the other, or is it just kind of similar?
Well, as I said, it's like a normal curve. And if you look at a normal curve, the majority of the population is right in the middle. You have the loop that goes up in the middle, and then it drags out at each end to a lesser number of people. The farther out, the extremes have only like 1 or 2% of the population, whereas in the actual middle, that's 50% of the population is in the middle. Mm.
It sounds like what Noam Chomsky calls the political class. So there's about 20% of the population that have some kind of thought about the future or the past or whatever. The rest of the people are just kind of relatively unaware, don't really think about it. And at the moment, in this point in history, I see a small minority of really forward-thinking people who are trying to advance the whole human race together, and a very small minority of really backward-looking control freak individuals who are trying to stop them.
Right. Well,
and everybody else just kind of caught in the middle.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The extremes is the ones that unfortunately the bias as far as leadership is concerned, the bias is for the retrospective. Because they are very extremely defensive about their lack of capability of being anticipatory. And so that, just imagine getting up in the morning and trying to figure out whether you should even get out of bed. That's what the kind of situation the retrospective have. In fact, when we were working at the hospital, The psychiatrists would call that the white knuckle syndrome. That when they wake up in the morning, their fists are clenched, and when you clench your fists, you'll notice your knuckles get white, and so that's what the retrospective symptom is one of those symptoms is that they're they're just saying, gee, should I get out of bed? Because if I get out of bed, I'm going to be confronted with a conflict situation, and which I'm not going to be able to resolve. So they try to minimize the conflicts.
In order to minimize the conflicts, they simply minimize changes. They minimize differences happening. They attempt to make sure that each day is the same as the last one.
That's right. Well, and also what you have, too, is that they procrastinate. So when they do have a conflict situation, they won't resolve it right away. And so they just keep procrastinating, hoping that the conflict's going to go away on its own.
Mm. You know, that sounds an awful lot like a government. I was speaking to some people the other day, and they sent these this list of questions, and they all seemed to be rhetorical questions. As far as I was concerned, they're pretty obvious, you know, in terms of maxims of law and whether or not the government's tyrannical. And what was interesting is that the vast majority of the responses that they received were no response at all.
That's right.
You know, it's just like, I don't like this. I'll ignore it and hope it goes away.
Right. Well, see, the government is a good haven for these people, as well as teachers, as well as lawyers, because nurses, because they don't have to make a decision. In the case of the lawyers, they have books, the law book, they're in their library. That's the answers. And so professors, deans, are mostly retrospective. But government is obviously has an operations book. And so that has all the answers that their pay grade allows them to have.
So these people would always insert themselves into bureaucracies of some kind.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, bureaucracy is a great place because the best defense a person can generate is a strong offense. And so if you become the leader of a group or leader of a country, they have all of the tools to be offensive. They have the controlling capability to generate wars, you know, like Hitler and Stalin and all these other guys. Mm. That's a defense mechanism.
Yeah, I've always found some of the most offensive people are those that are in positions of authority.
Right. So they're driven to that because that's their defense mechanism.
On the other hand, trying to change these people,
it's impossible.
It's not possible. You say like you're retrospective for life.
Yeah, from birth.
From birth,
right?
What causes this? Is it some kind of genetic malfunction or something like that? Predisposition to being a control freak douchebag?
Well, no. Let's go back. You know, when I first started, walked into that mental hospital, I said, "Gee, this is these people are have been put on. You know, this is they're victims." And after a while, when I found out that there were 30% of the population were like that, inside and outside, we had the full span. We had patients that were prospective. We had patients that were in the middle. We had patients that were retrospective. So that the population inside a mental hospital is almost identical to the population outside the mental hospital.
And that's interesting because I often feel like I'm living in a giant open air mental hospital sometimes. Right. You know what? Another thing that's interesting is is that you don't know who the crazy people are when you go into a mental institution, because the people who are there non-voluntarily seem crazy, but the people who are there working seem psychotic.
Well, see, that's where our research was very helpful on a clinical point of view. The best thing to be able to do from a clinical aspect is know what you can change as compared to what you cannot change. And that's, again, like the Beauty and the Beast was that Belle, by changing the environment of the Beast, morphed him into being the Prince Charming. But he was started out as both a prospective and ended up as prospective. That didn't change. But since she was prospective, and that was illustrated very much in that movie, that she was prospective because she was different than the village. Mm. And the village knew that she was different, and she knew she was different. Okay. The village were all non-anticipatory. They were doing the same thing day after day after day after day.
Yeah. See, I always wondered that mentality behind calling one person the village idiot, where it's like, for me, most of the village are idiots, and there's usually one person who isn't. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Welcome back. All right. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's the final segment that we have today with Dr. Victor H. Fisher. You can buy his book if you're in the United States off of Amazon.com. It's called, let me see if I get this right, Improving Your Thought Process. That's Improving Your Thought Process. Process from Amazon.com. You can pick that up now if you want to explain a little bit about that, Victor, before we wrap up the show. You kind of already have, haven't you?
Well, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
The book is in a downloadable format and is designed to be applied on a tablet. Needless to say, Amazon, since they supplied their own Kindle tablets, prefer you to buy their tablet, but it will work on your iPads and the other tablets that are available. And also for free, they'll give you a program that you can put it on your computer. So you can, that's the way I look. I don't have a tablet. And so I read the book, or I have many of the books, Kindle books, available in my library, because they're relatively inexpensive and they are nicely accessible. In fact, you can, in some of them are restricted. You can't make copies, but mine, you can make copies of sections of it. It would be tedious to do it otherwise. It's nicer for me to read it on my 19-inch screen, and it's a little 7-inch tablet.
yeah, and it's not a surprise to me that you don't have a tablet. As I understand it, you're not on any medications.
Pardon? What was that letter, Brian?
It's no surprise to me that you don't have a tablet. As you've informed me, you don't take any medications.
Oh, gee, yes. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, sorry. Well,
that's the difference between our language, the English language, and other languages.
Is that really it? Is the English language exclusively the uses of puns?
I guess so. Since there's 3,000 languages, it's hard to tell.
Yeah, it would be hard to tell unless you spoke all of them. And if you did, I mean, Be interesting,
see,
wouldn't it?
This is another interesting aspect about the brain, is that it allows 3,000 different languages, so that that must mean that it's that every one of those are translatable into another language. But the brain is easily adaptable to learn foreign languages.
Mm. Have you ever seen the movie The Fifth Element with Bruce Willis? He says, "Lady, I only speak two languages, English and bad English."
English and bad English, right. Yeah. Well, what's interesting here in China is that in the schools, they teach British English, and but the government publications in English is American English. So you sort of, as a linguist, I sort of wonder who's running the show.
Yeah, I was watching. There's a TV show on last night, and this American dude and a British guy, and British guy says, "Oh my God, what are you doing over here?" And the American guy goes, "What language is he speaking?" He says, "I'm speaking English." He's like, "I speak English, man. That doesn't sound anything like it."
Well, during my youth, I had an opportunity to take with a buddy of mine a bus ride from America up to Canada, and it was an overnight ride on the bus, and sitting near us, or next to us actually, was a girl from Scotland. And I could not understand her for at least 2 or 3 hours. Slowly, I was able to adapt to it, but it certainly wasn't English. It was Scottish.
A friend of mine said that the Scottish accent is a mixture between the Irish accent and alcohol.
Could be.
Close enough.
Yeah. Well, but talking about books, I'm starting yesterday, actually, writing, collating my next book, which is actually a second version update of my first book that I ever published back in 1967. And it is involved in teaching English, American English, and utilizes the what we've been just talking about, the research that I gleaned that long ago from our experience with the Heifrig. And it has been very, very successful. In fact, we had a very interesting situation. It was tested down at the McGuffey School at Miami University in Miami, Ohio. And professor of the reading department had tutored students, adults, really. He was tutoring adults, and a pair of mentally retarded twins came in to learn how to read and write. They both were married, and they were so illiterate that they were totally their wives were the only source of survival.
This wasn't by chance George and Jeb Bush, was it?
Touché. Yeah, it could be. No, they weren't, because they're not twins.
My bad.
But this adult student, the first five words that they learned in their first session contained the word in, I-N. And when he came to that word and was told what it was, he just glowed. And he says, so that's what that sign is on the door at the supermarket. He saw this IN, and he had no idea what it was until he saw it in the first lesson. Now that's really having a real problem as far as being able to survive, really, if you're that illiterate. That you can't even read, or understand what the IN is. But he ultimately learned 1,000 words. But the most important aspect, which is what I'm trying to bring out in this new book. Well, it's the old book, but it's been revised. Is that the only way that you can really learn a foreign language is that you must think in that language. You can't just translate, try to have some of these phrases that, where's the bathroom ways of describing your needs, how to get a taxi and things like that. That is not... is a total waste of time, because the only way you can communicate is by thinking in that language.
You know, that's interesting, and I think this might be an interesting thought to wrap up the show with, because people in my field, what we call truthers and what have you, I've come to the conclusion that we speak a completely different language to the rest of the population. When we say the words chemtrails, fluoride, or vaccines, or tyranny, or freedom, or something of that nature, a completely different brain and a completely different meaning is actually coming across. And I think part of the trauma of waking up to how the world really works is learning this different language of what things right. really are supposed to mean.
Well, look at the youth that we went through, where they would take the word bad and flip it on its head, saying, bad is good.
Yeah.
That was a bad, thing happened.
Yeah.
Which really say that's really good.
Yeah. Well, I think this conversation's been totally badass. Thank you, Victor. Dr. Victor H. Fisher, ladies and gentlemen, you can get his book, Improving Your Thought Process, on Amazon.com. It's been a great pleasure, and at 83 years old, you're still clicking your brain synapses in a reasonable format fashion. Congratulations, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me on.
All right. See you again sometime, mate. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening into the archives for the show up at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and also at AmericanFreedomRadio.com, plus the YouTube channel. Every day we have a version of it. That's Mr. News Guerrilla Media on YouTube. See you again sometime.